Today's keisho is on case 12 in the Umenkwan, the Mumonkan, the gate of no barrier. Case 12 is entitled Zuigan Calls His Master. Zuigan Gen Osho called to himself every day, "Master," and answered, "Yes, sir." Then he would say, "Be wide awake," and answer, "Yes, sir." Henceforth, never be deceived by others. "No, I won't." Mumon's comment, old Zuigan buys himself and sells himself. He takes out a lot of god masks and devil's masks and puts them on and plays with them. What for, eh? One calling and the other answering, one wide awake and the other saying he will never be deceived. If you stick to any of them, you will be a failure. If you imitate Zuigan, you will play the fox. Mumon's verse, clinging to the deluded way of consciousness, students of the way do not realize truth. The seed of birth and death through endless eons, the fool calls it the true original self. So to understand this koan, you have to imagine a scene like this. Let's say we all leave the zendo at the end of a day of sitting in the tsechin, and we all leave, and then you realize you left your coat or your sweater in here. So you come out of the dormitory and you come back in the building, and you come in here, and I'm sitting here by myself. And you don't want to disturb me, but you see that I'm talking. And I go, "Master." "Yes, Kurt, what is it?" I don't know what to do about this. And, "Well, don't worry, you know." Things might not work out. He says, "Don't worry, everything will be okay," right? So if you saw that, you might have second thoughts, right, about I don't know. But anyway, that's what the koan is about. So we get to see a scene of Zuigan talking to himself, and he's calling master. So that's the koan. Today, of course, is the last day of our spring 2009 sesshin. And of course, it's a beautiful day. And I was very happy to hear our friend the woodpecker has come back. I don't know if you've noticed, but there's a bird out there who makes a distinctive... This morning we retreated to that beautiful song. It was just astonishing, right? This woodpecker has a different song. I can't really imitate it. It's not. But you can hear him out there. He does have kind of a wise guy sound. You know, and he has lived in various trees right around the zendo for a number of years, or she, I should say, and she's back, or her daughter is back, you know. I'm so happy, and it just seems like today the birds are here, right? It's like all of a sudden all the birds have shown up and they're starting to sing. So it's a perfect way to end the sesshin. And once again this morning, everybody did a magnificent job. I must say that people were sitting very, very still. You know, it may be the case that you're tired, you know, and you may have gotten up this morning thinking, you know, thank God it's day five, you know. But even though part of you may have said, "Oh no, I don't want to get up," Please notice that the sitting in the Zendo, people are so still. It was just amazing. And as I say, you know, if you don't practice often on your own, that is, if you don't sit quite often, regularly, it's really not possible to make progress. So if you didn't do any sitting, or you did very little, and then you came to Sesshin, this would just be like an ordeal, you know. It would be like Zen boot camp, you know. There are many Zen centers in the United States where there's a core sangha, but then because of the need to raise funds, they, you know, open the Sesshin up to all comers, you know. And so you get people at Sesshin who are not necessarily well prepared, you know. And you can get people who are not necessarily serious. And I have been at Sesshins at those places. And some people just once a year they go to Sesshin, and basically they just have a terrible experience. You know, it's like an ordeal. It's like being dropped on a desert island for 7 days and surviving, right? You can go home and go, oh, I survived the Sesshin, you know. So there are such people, and they do it once a year. It's like taking a bitter medicine, you know. But if you practice regularly, when you come to Sesshin, it's a very different experience from that. If you keep doing Sesshin, it will be more and more wonderful. I promise you. I promise. You know, you need to practice on a daily basis, and if you don't do that, Sesshin isn't meaningful. But if you practice on a daily basis and you don't do Sesshin, you're really missing out on something quite remarkable. Well, the transformation here in everybody is always quite great, and I must say, if we had a video of day one versus today, it'd be quite impressive the way the stillness in this room. It's really, Sesshin is really an amazing institution, I must say. A number of people have done a great job at this Sesshin, everybody has. And a number of people have had really, a milestone breakthroughs. One person had a deep experience, the first deep experience of Mushin. And that's always, that's an exciting moment, you know. This person has been calling Mu for a number of years, you know. I do the old, look at my face, you know, now close your eyes, now look, can you see my face? Yes, you know, and so on. But this person really sort of like had a deep experience of Mushin, you know, and was suddenly sitting for a long period of time. And just amazed by the experience. And when that happens, I'm always thrilled, you know. That's a very wonderful moment. I don't believe that I experienced Mu. My first experience of Mu was not as intense as that and as dramatic as that. And that's really something else. Some people have really dramatic encounters with Mu. I've talked about this before. Xu Yun, the great Chinese master, talks in his autobiography, he talks about how he put some water on a, he built a little fire to make himself rice. He was in a hut in the mountains. And he built a little fire to make himself some rice. So he put water in the little pot and he put it on the fire, and then he threw some rice in, and he was going to let it boil until it cooked the rice, and then he was going to eat the rice. And he thought, okay, well, why don't I do some zazen while I'm waiting for the rice to cook? And he sat down on the cushion, and he had a deep experience of mu. And when he got up, he went over to the pan, thinking that, oh, the rice is probably done now. And the rice was cold, you know. It was like, who knows, maybe hours and hours in mushin. I myself have to say I've never had a mushin experience like that. But, you know, you never know. I might have one tomorrow, you know. I'll just keep practicing. And we all experience this beautiful world of Zen in different ways, you know. The great teacher and practitioner Deepa Ma could sit motionless for 2 days. And I must say, I've never sat motionless for 2 days, but I'm going to keep practicing. But I figure that if Deepa Ma has done it, that's really a good thing, you know, for me. Even though I haven't done it, you know, I figure that's a good thing for me. And the fact that this person had such a deep mushin experience, I'm just thrilled. I feel that there's a new bodhisattva in town. Really, you know, I hope this person takes this experience to heart and really builds Zen into the life to come, you know. But when those things happen, it's really cool. It's wonderful. And that experience of mushin is the center of Zen. It's really, Zen is all about encountering deeply that emptiness. And we call it emptiness anyway. And encountering it deeply and building your life around it, you know, and experiencing reality from the standpoint of that beautiful experience, which is, you know, emptiness is just a word. Nothingness is just a word, but it's certainly different from the ordinary consciousness, you know, an ordinary reality. There's a way to experience the world, and in that experience, or the world, when we experience it that way, has no form, it has no time, it's absolutely empty. This person said, you know, there was just nothing, I mean nothing there. And the sits rolled along, and I just thought that is so wonderful. You know, I myself did not experience mu with that kind of intensity, you know. But I'm so happy that this person has experienced it that way. And this is, you know, we all experience mu in our own way. It took me a long time to have a deep experience of mu. And I know that many people had gotten there before me in our group, but it was wonderful when it first happened. And once you have a little taste of this experience, you know, it can be nothing at first. It could be very trivial. You know, you're sitting on the cushion and you look at in your mind and it's blank, and you go, oh, that's nice. Mm-hmm. Or, I know that. I mean, that's kind of how it was for me. You know, it was like, oh yeah, okay. When do the mystical revelations start? You know, I was still that person. You know, so I was waiting for, you know, the sky to open up, and oh yeah, there's the blankness there. Yeah. But eventually, you experience it in a more and more profound way. And it begins to sort of like soak into your bones, you know what I mean? It's like, Zen is about like soaking in mu for 80 years. You know? Really. It's like you become a ripe old papaya by soaking up the mu for a long time. And it changes you little by little, subtly. It really makes you a very different person. And so far, I've been doing it for 30 years, and I'm pretty happy with the result. You know, I'm pretty happy. It's a pretty nice way to live. And I hope I live another 60 years. That would be nice. And just keep soaking up the mood, you know. I have met people who are quite old who have been practicing for a long time. And indeed, they're very kindly and deeply awakened people. I will keep practicing, and I hope that is the future that awaits me, you know. So Zen is about building your life around this experience. And it's a different way of living than we're culturally used to, you know. And I think there's much to recommend it, you know, actually. In the Western world, I think we're taught to live we're taught to live a certain way, and it's like this. Our culture, Western culture, teaches us that when we feel uncertain about how to live, or when we've been hurt, or when we've been, when we're feeling, basically unlovable, we're taught to imagine ourselves as being seen by a loving and all-knowing Father. Yeah? That's really like at the heart of the Western world, and actually other cultures too, right? If you were raised in like a Judeo-Jewish or Christian tradition, you know, often you are imagining, I would say, you're taught to see yourself as being watched by a father who loves you and is concerned about you, you know? And this is like such a deep habit in the Western world that we, even people who aren't religious, still sort of think this way. And so we're always sort of like imagining ourselves being visible to an observer, like in the sky. I'm not belittling this. This is actually like not just true for the Western world. I mean, I think that people in the Muslim world think of Allah also as a kind of like father who watches over them. And I think even though in the Hindu world it's a little bit more complicated. I think sometimes people think of God as also like a watching over a father, a benign father, or at least a father watching over you. You know? And this is very deep. Maybe this is true for many different cultures. You know, I often think that Christianity and Islam and certain forms of religion in India are all like bhakti religions. They're all devotional religions. And you know, when people are faced with confusion or unhappiness, or basically the religion says, look, you know, just imagine that there's a very good father watching, and try to do the things that are right, you know, that the Father would want you to do. So if you just, you know, you just, you're, the Father's watching, do what the Father says is good, and if you're, if you do it well, the Father will be happy, and the Father will love you. And this is like a very deeply ingrained habit, I think. It has worked, this approach has worked pretty well for maybe like 1,000 years, you know, actually. And many people take this reality for granted, even when they no longer are religious. It's like they're still going through life as though somewhere somebody is watching them, watching over them from a distance, and evaluating their conduct. I know that when I was a little, I was raised to believe this too, and I used to pray when I went to bed, and I always sometimes I would think, you know, when I was by myself, that God was watching me, you know. And I remember once my parents had a tremendous fight. We were visiting my grandmother up in upstate New York. And my parents just had this, one of many, but this was like an especially terrible fight. And my father got mad and he said, "That's it, I'm out of here, I'm leaving." And he got into the car and he drove away. And this was up in Plattsburgh. And I thought, and my grandmother said, "Your father is not coming back." And I just flipped out, you know. And I remember running into the bedroom and really just like falling on my knees and going, "Oh God, help, you know, stop this from happening." So, you know, I had this deep belief that this is like very human. It's very, I think it's very, actually very beautiful. You know, in the modern world, I think this belief system has sort of fallen apart in a certain way. The problem, there's a kind of problem with this, solution to human existence, you know, the bhakti solution, which is, you know, basically, you're good, and you try to be a lovable person in the eyes of a good father who watches you from a distance and who knows all, right? And so the emphasis is really on the father, but it's also on being on me. It's like, you know, it's like a two-way street. It's like the father is watching me, and I want to be a good person, so the Father will be happy with me. So this works pretty well, except in a couple cases. Okay, and one of them is that the Father might not be happy, right? And this is a big problem. Like, you know, it might be surprising to know this, but you know, if you read up on the history of religion. Most religious teachers in the Western world, right up until the 20th century, believed that most human beings were going to go to hell. No, this is true. I'm not lying. You know, all the people, the religious people who founded the United States, the different religious teachers, they all assumed that the great majority of people were bound for hell, and only a very small number were going to hell. One of the problems with like the bhakti solution, at least in the West, is that you're never really sure the Father is happy, right? It's like you're never really sure that the Father is happy, and actually you can never quite do enough to make sure that the Father is pleased, and this can be very unbearable. You know, lots of people, even though modern people don't think this way, until quite recently, lots of people You will read stories of people who said, I'm going to die now and I'm just terrified, I'm going to burn in hell. You know, I just probably haven't done enough to save myself. And this is quite widespread, and it's a predictable outcome of seeing reality this way, that you can't really be sure you've done enough to make the Father happy. And there's like a relentless quality to being observed by the Father all the time. You know, it's like, you know, am I really good enough? You know, am I really? And the other thing is that in the modern world, most people, or many people, don't believe in God anymore. And so there's no Father looking down, but I'm still here, and it's all about me, you know? And so I think the modern world, the world we live in, is like a combination of these two worlds. It's like either it's all about me, but I might go to hell, or it's all about me and there's no gods, but I'm still looking around for somebody to give me what the good Father in the sky used to give me, if this makes any sense. I might get attached to some authority figure, you know, like a professor or something like that. And I want that person to look at me and make me and say, you're real and you really matter and you're really a good person. And so this is a very powerful dynamic, you know. People get attached to leaders like Mao in China. You know, everybody dressed the same way Mao did. Everybody carried Mao's book. And they all wanted to just be visible. They wanted to be like Mao and loved by Mao. And Mao would actually say things like, you know, I love you all. And everybody wanted to be like loved by Mao. And this is like a sinister thing, but very typical. In my own life, I had a graduate student I was talking to once, and she actually was like devastated. And I said, what's wrong? And she said, I said hello to Michael Warner, and he didn't say hello to me. You know, and it's funny, right? But Michael Warner became like God for her, right? It's like he was going to look at her and go, you're a good person. And he was her good father, right? And so this is the modern world. And I think it's not, it encourages people actually to be very unhappy. And I think it encourages people actually to be very self-centered, you know, in my opinion. And as I say, you know, you either have people and it also creates another problem too, right? I mean, in the Bible, if you read the Bible, it really does say that homosexuality is really like an abomination, you know? And it also says other things too. It says in the Bible, if you read the Bible, it says, you know, actually you shouldn't touch a woman who is in her period. And another thing you're not supposed to do is mix wool and cotton cloth, you know? The rule book that's supposed to make you loved by the Father is like a very confusing book, right? So all of this, I think, is like a formula for unhappiness, and I think that right now in the world, people are trying to. I think these devotional religions are actually on the decline. And I think one of the reasons people are interested in things like Zen, it's all over the world, you know. In India, there's a revival of interest in meditation, you know. So you have Mr. Goenka's place, his place is, and you have Ravi Shankar and people like this, and people don't want a devotional practice anymore. They want to experience directly reality or the divine or something like that in a different way. And in America too, something like Zen is very popular, you know. And I think people don't quite know why, what they're looking for, but I think they're definitely, I think that the there's another way to live other than trying to be seen as real and to be loved, you know. Because I think one of the biggest problems with that is that you know, actually, there's a problem with that, you know. And it's this, you know, if I sit down on the cushion and I start watching my breath, I go into like the deepest part of myself, what I find is emptiness. This is my personal experience, you know. If you sit down on the cushion and you watch your breath and you go through like the top of your mind is saying, oh, when I get home I have to pay those bills. And then there's a part of your mind which is just sort of saying, oh God, I wish I'd gotten more sleep. And you think of shoes, and then you think of something else, and then you think of... And then there's a part of your mind that has memories, and there's a part of your mind that sees images, and then there's a part of your mind that has these emotions, and so on and so on. And you go down, 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 down. You get to the core of the self, and it turns out that it turns out to be like empty. And when I get to the core of myself, I don't find that there's like a little Kurt in there, you know? Now, this is very important, you know? I get in there and it's not like I say, oh, here's my true self. You know, in Zen we say true self, but it's a metaphor, right? Because when I get to the core of myself, it's just what this person experienced for several hours. It's just this nothing there, you know? And the bookstores are full of books that say, you know, finding yourself and making $1 million. You know, basically that's the theme of the book. Or, and even in schools, you know, there's a whole self-esteem curriculum, and it's like everybody's a winner, you know, so. We have a contest, and everybody runs a contest, and everybody gets a ribbon, you know. And it's like we want to build up people's self-esteem. Now, self-respect and self-esteem are very important, and everybody does want to be loved. That's part of life. So I'm not belittling that. It's very important for people to love and to be loved. It's very important for people to be respected and to be acknowledged as a person. That's very important, but the way we seek those things is not necessarily the right way. And I think it creates instability and unhappiness in our lives because we haven't come to terms with this thing inside ourselves, which is this emptiness. Zen does not say, and Buddhism does not say, please, if you're feeling lonely and frightened, if you're feeling unworthy and dignified, if you feel incompetent and uncertain, just imagine that there's a father who loves you, looking down on you. That's not the Zen way. What the Zen way is quite different. It says, look, let's go down into the self and see what we find there. And if we find a father who's looking at us, great. And if we find a little Kurt, great. And whatever else we find, gods or devils, let's look. And we go down, 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 down. Inside the self, there's this empty space, you know. Now, that could be terrible or it could be wonderful, if you imagine it. But when you really experience it, it's quite wonderful. It's really quite wonderful to be empty. But for most people, this is the worst thing that can happen to them, right? You know, if somebody says to my life is empty, you think, oh, that's really pitiable. Right? Or if somebody says, you know, you're an empty person, they mean it. They don't mean it as a compliment, except in the Zen world, right? Here we say, you're a really empty person. Thanks. But elsewhere, it's an insult, right? And it's because, the reason's obvious, right? But the truth is, at the heart of our existence, there is a big zero, in my opinion, that's the truth. And it's not an occasion for mourning or unhappiness. It's actually incredible, in my opinion. It's an incredible and wonderful thing. And so Zen is all about like soaking in that emptiness for a million years, basically. And it's if you soak in that vat of mu for a million years, you'll turn into Buddha, you know, basically. And it's like a last one in, you know, I'm going to hold my nose and jump in because it's so wonderful. In Sashin, it's like we're all jumping into the big pool of mu, and we're going to saturate ourselves in mu. Eventually, you know, you become a very different kind of person. It's not necessary, really. Let me put it this way. There was recently a book came out by a guy named Bill Porter, who also translates books under the name Red Pine. And he did a travel book on China. And I read a couple chapters in it, and then I recommended it to Jaro. I sent it to Jaro and said, oh, this is a wonderful book. And then I got a call from my friend John Sunston, who I've talked about. John Sunston has been married 3 times. 4, I think. And I have to tell you the truth, he's been doing a lot of Zazen, but I love John Sunston, but he has kind of like a dirty old man aspect, you know? And there's an aspect of John I just can't stand. Right? He's like a leering old man, you know? Really, I mean, he just is. It's unpleasant and it's unflattering, you know? So, you know, John, I don't know, he's just never, he has kind of a smutty mind, in my opinion. You know? So, anyway, I recommend it. I didn't read the whole book, but I read it, and I recommended it thoroughly, unreservedly to Jaro, and sent her a copy. And then John called me up and said, I'm reading this new book, and he told me about parts of it that I thought were really unpleasant, you know, and I thought, ooh, you know, I shouldn't have sent that to Jaro. it's a book that my friend with his dirty mind would like, you know. So anyway, there is a wonderful chapter in there, however, the part that I read that I liked, and it's about the fact that the great Zen master Xu Yun has become kind of very famous in China. Xu Yun practiced Zen for more than 100 years, literally. He lived to be older. He was born at the time of the American Civil War. He lived to be 119 or 18 years old. And they have his birth records, you know. So anyway, he was a great Zen master, and he was beaten up by the Red Guards and died eventually from the beating that he sustained. But now he's become, like this incredible figure of inspiration for millions of Chinese Buddhists. And they had a conference on Xu Yun, and all these people were talking about what an amazing person Xu Yun was, you know. And you know, he could sit down and he could meditate for 7 days without, and this is true. He went to Thailand, he sat down for 7 days, he didn't move. And there were hundreds of people. He did a session in Thailand. The king of Thailand invited him. And he did a session, he sat down, there were witnesses the whole time. It wasn't like the Buddha boy, if you've been following that in the newspaper, there's some guy, you know, they put a fence around him at night, you know, and they had people, a French photographer snapped him, you know, eating some grapes or something on the sly, you know. This was real, you know. He sat down and he didn't move for 7 days, you know. And so all these people were going, oh my God, 7 days. He had amazing attainment, you know. And but one of the guest speakers was a student of Xu Yuan. And somebody said, you know, at the question period, they said, we want, you know, please tell us about his amazing powers and attainments. And the guy said, listen, if it's something that can be attained, it can be lost. And so Xu Yuan wasn't interested in attainment. Right. There's really, from his standpoint, there was nothing to attain. And I just thought, that's it. That's it. It's not about attainment. There's nothing to attain. And it's hard, maybe, to imagine, you know, I mean, none of the people, I'm not sure any of the people in the audience understood what he was talking about. Because they're all, you know, the modern world raises us. I mean, look, the modern world raises us to be loved by a Father in heaven who is going to approve of us. And to get his approval, we'll do all kinds of things. We'll get a PhD, and we'll try to get a job at Harvard or Yale, and if we don't, we'll get depressed. Jackie tells this wonderful story. She was kind enough to help me find a publisher for this book I wrote. And anyway, she said, you know, writers are only happy in very rare periods. You know, when they write their book and they're unhappy till they find a book agent, and then they're happy for a little while, but then they're unhappy again until they find a press. And then they're unhappy again because they didn't find a better press. And then they're unhappy until the book comes out. And if their book is not on the bestseller list, they're unhappy for a long time, right? And if it gets on the bestseller list, they're only happy for a little while because they're unhappy that it's not higher on the list or that it's not on the list longer, right? And I just think that's human nature, at least in the modern world, right? I have to say, I'm very grateful for her help, and I'm glad the book is going to be in print. I don't think it would have gotten into print without her help. But attainment is not what it's about. And the truth is that whether you get on the New York Times bestseller list or not, is not going to solve the problem we all feel when we're unhappy about ourselves. And we can go from this father to that father to that father looking, and we can do everything under the sun to make ourselves lovable. But actually, I believe personally that this monk had it right. You know, that I think real freedom is realizing there's nothing to attain. There's nothing to attain. And this is, in my opinion, this is like amazing freedom. In that state, I mean, you know, my father wanted so much to be loved. It was very interesting. My father wanted so much to be loved. He was desperately hungry for approval and love. But I don't think he had a lot of love in him. Or another way to put it is he hadn't found a way to let that love out. And I think the interesting thing about emptiness is that that when we stay in emptiness long enough, the lovability of myself is not a particularly big problem anymore. And what really you find is that you are just spontaneously loving. You know, spontaneously loving. And I think it's because you're not trying to be loved. You know? I honestly think this is true. It's like, when you're not trying to be, it's like, I don't know, I don't think I can say it any better than that. I don't know if you've ever seen the movie The Wizard of Oz, but the end of The Wizard of Oz, the wizard says to the Tin Man, who doesn't have a heart, he says the important thing is not whether we have a heart, whether we love, but whether we're loved by others. I think that's 100% wrong. You know, I think that's the worst. Millions of little kids saw that movie, and I think went through miserable lives. The odd thing is that if you go into that place long enough, that blank place, that dark place, you find yourself mysteriously drawn to others, yeah, and in the most loving way. And when you look back at yourself, there's nobody there. It's a different way of living life. It's the opposite of wanting to be seen and made real by the good Father in the sky, in my opinion. Very different way to live. So, everybody came here today, came here this week to encounter that deep mushin. And I'm happy to say that nothing was attained. Nothing was attained here. And that is so important, right? It's so beautiful. Nothing has been attained here. Zuigan Gen Osho called to himself every day, "Master," and answered, "Yes, sir." Then he would say, "Be wide awake," and answer, "Yes, yes, sir." Henceforth, never be deceived by others. No, I won't. Mumon's comment: old Zuigan buys and sells himself. He takes out a lot of God masks and devil's masks and puts them on and plays with them. What for, eh? One calling and the other answering. One wide awake and the other saying he will never be deceived. If you stick to any of them, you will be a failure. So we're all afraid of being a failure, see? Unlovable, too. If you imitate Zuigan, you play the fox. Mumon's verse: clinging to the deluded way of consciousness, students of the Dharma do not realize truth. The seed of birth and death through endless eons, the fool calls it the original self.